We do not have a quorum, so we'll hold on the minutes. Members, just to give you an idea of where we're going today, we have three very special guests today. Our new commissioners of health, of the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Commerce are here, and we're very pleased to welcome them. We'll give them some time to tell us a little bit about themselves and some of their approach to things, and we look forward to working with them to meet some of the tremendous challenges we face. And then we will be hearing House File 8, and we will be voting on that bill before we close the committee today. So with that, I'd like to welcome Commissioner Mike Rothman from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Commissioner Rothman, thank you so much for being here, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here, and as you can imagine, just getting myself started. I started Wednesday, but at the same time, hitting the ground running, and know a lot of the folks here, a lot of folks on the on your committee, and members. I want to make sure that at the outset we establish an open channel communication, that as you have legislation and questions, we're here to help, but also vice versa, that we'll do what we can to work with you on various issues. My name is Mike Rothman. Before Wednesday, I was in the private sector. I was an attorney at Winthrop and Weinstein. And some of the overlap, at least for what you do today, my practice involved insurance regulation and insurance law. And that was pretty much all varieties, all lines, all kinds of insurance, and both property and casualty, as well as life and health and disability. But also, I did a little bit more than that in regulatory law, so it wasn't just limited to the insurance arena. But for your purposes today in the health arena and the issues that you address, I'm very familiar with them, and have a long history, going back to when I worked in the legislature on insurance issues as staff. And then I went out to California in 1992 to 2002. I worked on two of the largest insurance insolvencies in the history of the United States. One was, if you remember, Executive Life Insurance Company and Mission Insurance Company on the PNC side. So I come to the job with a lot of experience in those areas, but then we also have in the Department of Commerce's jurisdiction energy, banking, and about 22 plus industries that we regulate, including realtors, insurance agents, collection agencies, and all that. You asked us to at least to address at the outset. I don't want to take too much time, but my philosophy as I start my job at the department, and as I've talked to people, talked to committees, I've presented at the Senate Energy Committee yesterday, the Senate Commerce Committee today, and I'm happy to come in here too as well, just sort of on the substantive stuff, but there's really three things. Number one is a high priority for the department, both as a constitutional and a statutory obligation and responsibility, and that is to protect consumers in the marketplace. And the second is to work with businesses in Minnesota to make sure that they have the economic opportunities to succeed in a responsible way. And then the last is to make sure that we have a high level of integrity in our regulation, both from the business perspective, they understand that, and well for the consumers of our state. And to say that in Minnesota we have a high level of focus on those issues. So I've emphasized that with my with the department staff as I start. We're addressing some issues that we're dealing with at the outset. And the last thing I would say is that we're going to reset the button on our legislative priorities and come in and take a fresh look at that. We will come back and put that together and start working with you. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would just, again, I thank you for having the opportunity to come and introduce myself to your members. And again, we have an open door. You can always call, talk to me, and we have a terrific professional staff, and very pleased to have the opportunity to work with the administration and serve the people of Minnesota.
Thank you, Commissioner Rothman. Do you have any members of your staff here at all that you'd like to introduce?
Sure. We have Deputy Commissioner Manny Munson-Regala. Tina's here, too. Tina's up here. She's health care reform and works on our legislative stuff as well. Is there anybody else? Nobody else. They all went back to... We had at least 10 people over this morning, but they're back working.
Great. Well, we appreciate your taking the time to be here. Congratulations on your appointment, and we look forward to working with you. Yeah. Members, do you have any questions, anything you'd like to ask of the commissioner? I'm sure we'll have him back here probably frequently as we address a lot of these challenges. Yes, Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Rothman, do you have your priorities yet, what your 1, 2, 3 priorities of your department are in the upcoming session? Or,
Mr. Chair, Representative, at this time, I haven't sorted through the priorities, except let me just say this, that health care reform is a high priority of the administration. It's a high priority of the of three departments. You'll be hearing a lot of that. Health, Human Services, and Commerce all have concurrent jurisdiction over pieces of that puzzle. So in terms of, for example, the health insurance exchange, that's a high priority for the Department of Commerce and is one of the pieces of the puzzle that we have. So the answer is yes, we're keeping that on our radar screen, for at least with respect to the jurisdiction of this committee. We may be looking at other things. And then there's high priorities in other areas, like sort of the energy area, and then in commerce as well. We'll be looking at, for example, NAIC Model Act Law implementation on a few things.
Great. Well, Commissioner Rothman, again, thank you for being here. And like I said, we look forward to working together with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Members, seeing that we have a quorum, I think Representative Quam, I saw, was anxious to move the minutes. And so Representative Quam moves the minutes. Any discussion of the minutes? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And we have the minutes approved. Our next commissioner guest is Lucinda Jensen with the Department of Human Services. And Ms. Jensen, welcome to the committee. She's making her way up. Congratulations on your commissioner appointment. And on behalf of the committee, we look forward to working with you. But why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your priorities, and where you see things going in human services.
Right. And Representative Baldwell, committee, thank you all so much for asking me to come and talk with you. Mm-hmm. I think I'll probably be here more often. I noticed someone just handed me a copy of House File 128. So those of you who are on Representative Abler's committee, I know that preceded this, you all have already been talking about the Department of Human Services. And can I just say, I really view all of this in this session, and I know there's politics and difference, but I know that we all have the agenda of moving Minnesota forward. And I see this as really the beginning of a conversation, and I'm delighted to be here to begin that conversation with all of you. My background, I am a lawyer. Please don't hold that against me. I see there are a few other lawyers in the room. I graduated from law school in 1983, and I practiced law in a large Minneapolis law firm. But I saw the light before Commissioner Rothman. And after 10 years, when they're about to hand me my plaque saying, congratulations, you're a partner, you've been here 10 years, I thought, wait, I went to law school to do public service. And so I joined the, came upstairs and met with then Chief Deputy John Thunheim and joined the Attorney General's office, where my first client was the Department of Human Services. So I got into these issues quickly, and I loved them. I learned a lot. I knew nothing about Medicaid financing, and suddenly I knew a lot about Medicaid financing and nursing home rates and, many of the things your committee deals with. Now, when I was at the AG's office, I ultimately became a deputy attorney general and also had jurisdiction over kind of representing the departments of health, the health licensing boards, and then some other things like the human rights department and the PUC, but fortunately things this committee probably doesn't have to deal with. I left the attorney general's office when my boss, Skip Humphrey, ended his term as Attorney General, and I went to work as Chief Deputy County Attorney to open the office and set up the office for then County Attorney Amy Klobuchar. And I, it was really interesting because I got to see the other side of much of what I had done at the state. So I supervised an office. I learned a lot about criminal law and the criminal justice system, which was very helpful to me. But I also learned about our child support system, our child protection system, you know, a lot of the important county functions that the counties work so closely with DHS. And I think, I'm hoping that that helped prepare me some for this job, too, because I think having those good relationships with the counties that do so much of this work is going to be very important for all of us. And, you know, and I'm kind of a doer, so even though I supervised, like, the child support division, I made sure I went and tried some child support cases. So I really tried to dive in and know those issues. I then started my own law firm here in St. Paul, you know, joined the chamber, did a lot of the, you know, I had that entrepreneurial spirit in me. I did that for 5 years until Hamline asked me to come and start their health law institute. As I said, I love to start things. And I started that program, and I've loved it. But when Governor Dayton asked me to take this on, it was really a call back to some of the human service issues, the health care issues, because I've worked throughout my career on health law and policy that I've always, always loved. And some look at this time and say, why would you want to be dealing with human services and health care issues in this difficult time? And I think this is the time we all need to be focusing on this and trying to bring all of our best ideas to do creative work, to do better work, to do more cost-efficient work, and that's certainly what I want to do at the department. You know, I don't have kind of an agenda. I've actually had one less working day than Commissioner Rothman. He started on Wednesday. I did on Thursday. But I would say some of the things I certainly know I want to look at and ask a lot of questions about. I think I go into, like, these meetings with the department saying, well, why? Why are we doing it this way? And sometimes I get answers and think that makes sense. And sometimes I think get answers that are more like, well, this is how we've always done it. And those are the things I think we all are called upon to reexamine. I certainly want to look at you know, accountability and transparency in our healthcare contracting. But I also want to look at how we pay for healthcare. Medicaid is a huge payor. We need to look at some of the things that I see, like Representative Huntley and many of you who've worked on the state health reforms. Our state was doing some of these things with medical homes and, you know, bundled payments and ACOs long before the federal government did them. But we need to do more of that because we need to pay more for value, for outcomes, not just for tests and procedures. I really want to focus on that as well. I want to look, we're a regulator too at DHS. I want to figure out how we can streamline that. DHS, you know, there's some things we do well. There's some things I think we could do better. We regulate more than, I think, 23,000 healthcare providers. We need to take a look at that. I think overall our healthcare system is very well run here in Minnesota in many respects, but there's clearly fraud in the system, and we need to go after that vigorously. Other states have models for that. I want to examine some of them. I certainly want to look at all of this in light of federal reform. We need to take advantages of what federal reform offers us, including the funding advantages, but I think we want to approach federal reform, and DHS will be a major player in that, in a way that does this in a Minnesota way. We do not want to have federal reform come down upon us in a cookie-cutter fashion. We have expertise, and we should make sure that whatever comes our way, we fashion a way that works for our citizens and from the human services perspective, from those most vulnerable citizens as well. So I just thank you for this opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Commissioner Jessen, thank you. You know, so much of what you said I certainly agree with. I think a lot of us around the table are facing the same challenges and see the same priorities. So I think we're very well aligned based on your comments. Members, any questions of the commissioner? Obviously, we welcome you, and we're glad to have you aboard. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Commissioner Jessen.
You all know where to find me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You want to applaud, that's
yeah,
fine, too.
That's
yeah. Next, we have Dr. Edward Ellinger, who is our new Department of Health Commissioner. Dr. Ellinger, thank you so much for being here. Welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Representative Gottlieb, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health for the Minnesota Department of Health, and we had 5 days, 4 days, and 3 days. I've been on the job for 3 days, so it's nice to come before you early on in my tenure here. And I really appreciate having you give me the chance to explain a little bit about who I am, because I think my background will tell you a little bit about what I'm going to be bringing to the department and what I hope for the department. I'm originally from, and I hate to say it here, I'm originally from Green Bay, Wisconsin. And I went to the University of Wisconsin, and I, you know, I have two daughters, though, who are avid Viking fans. So I'm used to controversy and conflict. And I worked for 16 years for the University of Minnesota. So I know, you know, where allegiances have to be. I've been in the state, though, for 30 years and consider myself a Minnesotan and really love the environment and the sociology and the economics and the health of this state. When I started out going into medicine, I wanted to be a general practitioner in a rural community. So I developed my own form of a family practice residency. This was before they actually had family medicine, and I did an internship and residency in internal medicine and pediatrics with the idea of going into a small town and being a general practitioner. Well, so I did that, and for several years worked in a couple small towns in Montana, seeing 40 to 60 patients per day, and I quickly realized that I could be in that town for 40 years seeing patient after patient after patient, and I would really not really impact the overall health of those little towns. I'd certainly impact the health of those individuals that came to my practice, but there were bigger issues like obesity and alcohol and tobacco and violence and things that I couldn't deal with on a one-on-one basis. So I looked for new ways of approaching that, and that's when I really got turned on to public health, and I went and got some training in public health at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Still with the idea of going back into a rural community to practice. And in fact, my research at the University of North Carolina was how to use resources in rural communities to improve the health. But my wife had other notions. She decided it was her turn to get some education, so she got accepted to the University of Minnesota in a PhD program in physical activity. So I ended up in Minnesota with the Minneapolis Health Department working on urban health issues and realized those were also incredibly complex and important issues. So bringing my interest in research and in rural healthcare, then combining it with the urban focus, I think really gave me an idea that there are needs throughout the state. And what I also found working with the Minneapolis Health Department is that medicine and public health are not separate entities. Sometimes they function as separate entities, but really they need to be integrated if we're really going to have the biggest impact on the health of populations. So Minneapolis Health Department was providing clinical services. I was seeing patients, but also doing public health, and it really was a nice model. The other thing I learned in Minneapolis is that you have to be connected with the community. You have to listen to the community. You have to pay attention to what they're saying and actually get the community involved in some of the decision-making related to their health. So I brought that forward, particularly then when I went to the University of Minnesota. Minneapolis stopped their clinical services, so I went to the University of Minnesota and Boynton Health Service, which again provides medical care and public health services, but works closely with the community of students, faculty, and staff, and really found a way that you could really impact by having medicine and public health come together. And certainly at the University of Minnesota, as a land-grant institution, the role that state agencies play in the overall health of the state of Minnesota made this job as Commissioner of Health one that was really intriguing to me. I see that the State Health Department has a role throughout the state in the medical care area and in the public health area, and particularly, I hope, with the little push for me, that we bring those together, both in health care reform and in the way that medical care is given, that we increase some of the preventive services, some of the health promotion services, that we really get the private sector and public sector working collaboratively on issues that affect the community and actually getting the community involved in stating what their needs are, what their approaches need to be, and how we can help communities move forward. So as I start this job after 3 days learning a lot and really coming forward with the idea that one, priorities, the State Health Department is well recognized statewide and nationally as a premier public health agency. And certainly I would want to maintain that excellence and improve even further the quality of the public health services. I also realize that we have healthcare reform, as the two previous commissioners mentioned, that we need to work collaboratively. And I think that having a public health perspective on healthcare reform will add a different dimension, will add a Minnesota dimension that will help us really craft a way of delivering medical care services, insurance coverage for the population that might be different than in any other state. And I also, from my work in rural areas and in urban communities, another priority will be health equity, reducing the disparities that are in our state. We are one of the healthiest states in the nation, but there are populations in this state that really are not benefiting from all of the advantages that we have. And I think I've discovered from my research and my practice that if we can reduce those disparities, everyone benefits, even those at the top benefit from having everybody healthier. So those are going to be the priorities that I'm going to be pushing, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you. I look forward to working with you in the months and years ahead, and certainly the staff at the Minnesota Department of Health are available to help you with any technical issues that you may have, and we look to be collaborative partners with you. Thank you.
Dr. Ellinger, thank you so much. And welcome again.
Thank you.
Look forward to working with you. We have some huge challenges and some huge opportunities, I think, too, in the area of healthcare reform in the state of Minnesota in particular. So look forward to working with you. Members, any questions, comments? This is a great opportunity. We have our new commissioner in front of us. Yes, Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair and Dr.
Ellinger.
I'm curious about your position on innovative ways of delivering health care in rural or greater Minnesota, where some of the access and variability of the different types of health care maybe aren't there. How would you look at, philosophy-wise, trying to deliver that? Would you do mobile clinics? What kind of approach to improve rural health care would you take?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Yeah, Representative Gottlieb, Representative Chen. One of the things that I did with my research is how to improve the use of resources in rural communities, how to take advantage of the nurses who are there, the chiropractors who are there, the social workers who are there, and the school teachers, all of the other folks who have some interest in improving the health. And we don't have people function many times at the highest level of their expertise. And I think one of the ways that we can really improve is finding out what resources are in those communities, having them function at the highest level of their expertise. Well, I was one of the first physicians in the country to really help train mid-level practitioners to work in rural areas. And I think mid-level practitioners are going to be one of the answers to access to care. But then we also have all of the new technologies that allow us to connect major metropolitan areas and rural communities through telemedicine, through e-medicine, which I think healthcare reform may give us some opportunities to try some new approaches to fund those kinds of activities and work to improve the quality of those and the effectiveness of those.
Very good. Representative Quam? Done. Very good. Any other questions? Great. Commissioner Ellinger, thank you so much.
Thank you for
welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Next item on our agenda is consideration of House File 8, and I will start off by moving House File 8 that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. And then I have an author's amendment to offer as well, but I'll turn over the gavel to our Vice Chair. Madam Chair, I will move the A21 amendment.
Representative Gottwalt moves the A21 amendment. Please present the amendment.
Members, I'll explain the amendment briefly, if I may, Madam Chair and members. The A21 amendment is not a substantive change to the bill, really, except that it details more specifically. The bill itself applies to in practice, right out of the chute, it's going to apply to adults without children. We would like to extend it to adults with children, families as well. The bill speaks about seeking federal waivers What the A21 amendment does is make more specific where we would go within the federal government to seek that waiver and the date specific by which we would seek that waiver. So it's really not a substantive change to the bill, but a greater detail. And so I would ask for your support.
Representative Gottwald has moved the A21 amendment. Is there any discussion or questions to the amendment? Seeing no discussion, those opposed say aye, or those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. The motion prevails.
Very good. I might be seeking a new chair here, or vice chair here. No. You're doing fine. Madam Chair and members, if I may, I'll begin by presenting the bill. Some of you are familiar with the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program. This is very much the same bill we offered last year. It received a fair amount of hearing time and a fair amount of attention, and I'm pleased to bring it once again here. I think that this approach is an approach that we're going to see not only at the state level, but possibly at the federal level. Some people have asked about how this may or may not dovetail with some of the federal changes that are coming forward, and I think you'll find as we present the bill, it actually works pretty well with them. What we are doing, in essence, with the Defined Minnesota Contribution Program is moving from a Defined Minnesota Care Benefit capitated model that we've been doing for some time since the early 90s, and which is experiencing some serious cost issues and overrun issues, to what we would call a defined contribution or a defined subsidy. In essence, this bill provides a sliding fee schedule subsidy to low-income Minnesotans so that they can afford to purchase coverage on the open market. And this bill really stems from a conversation we had with a number of parties about what are we trying to accomplish with Minnesota Care and what are we trying to accomplish for low-income Minnesotans. And the answer kind of came at the 10,000-foot level that what we're really trying to do is help Minnesotans afford coverage that they otherwise can't afford. It's really the affordability issue. And so we started talking about how we might do that, and this bill is the end result. The first section, as I mentioned earlier, applies this bill to people eligible for Minnesota Care between 133% and 275% of the federal poverty guidelines. Initially, the bill applies to only adults without children, but we would, again, as I mentioned earlier, be seeking waivers, federal waivers, to try to include families with children. There will not be a premium charged. There is not a premium charged directly to the person under this proposal. Instead, what they have is a subsidy that the Department of Human Services will be responsible for paying to whatever insurance, private insurance, they choose on an individual basis. And then they will have the additional cost-sharing portion responsibility themselves. So they're not paying a premium to the state, and so they're not being charged by the state a premium. This is the state participating in the cost of coverage. Another important thing to keep in mind about this is the money that these recipients will have to go buy private insurance, individual insurance, is, in our minds, combined with what they're already paying for Minnesota Care coverage. So right now they have premium cost-sharing under Minnesota Care. Might be as, hypothetically here, $130 a month, let's say, they're paying on Minnesota Care. They still have that money, and now they have a subsidy in addition to that. Might be $150. So you take the two combined, you've got about $280 there with which to go to market and buy individual insurance. Some people have looked at the sliding fee schedule, the base schedule in this bill, and have said, gee, these dollar amounts really don't buy you much. You have to keep in mind they're already spending money out of their pocket for Minnesota Care, and that's really the combined amount that they have with which to buy coverage. So that's the defined contribution portion. Again, it's a sliding fee schedule that is adjusted based on age and on income. The determination of a defined contribution amount, I had the question asked, we have these three different levels. What do you do for people in between? And there is language in the bill that suggests that the commissioner needs to find a way to, on an equal basis, fill in those gaps. So it is a continuous sliding fee schedule in between these amounts specified in the bill. The commissioner is required to administer the defined contributions, calculating and processing those amounts. and then paying the defined contribution to the health plan company or AMCHA as applicable. There are provisions in this bill for anybody who, once they're in the private insurance market, is denied coverage, because there will be underwriting involved. If they are denied coverage like anybody else who seeks private insurance coverage, they have the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association to go to and all of those options. The bill, in turn, provides for a 20% increase in the premium subsidy for those people who end up in the AMCHA pool. And so there is an increased amount of money to help them afford that. In addition, the bill also provides very specific provision for backfilling that amount through the Health Care Access Fund. So AMCHA is made whole under this bill through the Health Care Access Fund. I think ideally long-term, the mechanism we'd like to see, and perhaps there would be an amendment along the way, we would like to see this be assessed back to the marketplace as is done for everybody else who goes into AMCHA. If there is an outstanding balance for the cost of delivering care to those people, it is assessed back to the marketplace. The Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association is part of the reason we have such a high level of people covered in the state of Minnesota, and this takes advantage of that. I mentioned earlier seeking federal approval waivers to involve families with children. We think if this is good for individuals, it can also be good for families. And then we kept in a section some people thought we ought to eliminate, because now we have early medical assistance. You know, aren't we taking care of these people already? But I think many of us bipartisanly have talked about the need to reform how we deliver care to low-income Minnesotans, especially those below 133% of the federal poverty guideline. So this bill directs the Commissioner of Human Services to develop and present to the legislature by December 15th of this year recommendations for how to do that better. So, you know, some of us looked at the ACO approach that was working marginally well for GAMC people here in the Twin Cities area. We think those kinds of reforms are still needed for low-income Minnesotans, and we don't want to short-circuit those reforms. We think we need to move ahead with them. And I've heard a lot of bipartisan support for that kind of thing. Regardless of whether you have, if you look at the GAMC population, and particularly the population now in early MA, these are people who are extremely poor, most of them with severe mental health issues and chemical dependency issues, and the health systems and healthcare providers I've talked to who are in charge of trying to deliver care to these people almost unanimously agree it should not be done in the ER. It should not be done in our detox centers. It should not be done in our jails. We should be doing it through other approaches, which include clinics, trying to get these people in for care early, make sure that they're able to stay on their medications, and catching things early on. We don't want to short-circuit those things. We want to see more of that kind of thing happening for low-income Minnesotans. So this section has been left in to try to engage the Department of Human Services. I heard the commissioner in her comments earlier talk about her desire to do some of these things as well. And so we hope to engage that within the bill. And members, that's a brief overview of the bill. I would now turn it over to John Tyler with the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, who's been a collaborator. We've had a large number of people with input on this bill, but I would ask John to kind of walk through a presentation on some of the positive aspects of this bill.
Mr. Tyler, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Tyler. I am actively involved with the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters Legislative Committee. I am also a co-principal in the Boies & Tyler Financial Group. I'm a licensed health insurance agent working in both the individual and the employer-based marketplace with next month about 30 years of experience. The efforts that we are talking about here in this presentation will be on the I don't know how many of you have the PowerPoint presentation in front of you or not, but it'll be on the overheads here as well, in your handouts. The Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program, or House File 8, the objective is to provide, you know, better, more comprehensive insurance coverage for adults without children, and with the amendment, adults with children currently enrolled in Minnesota care. The objective here, without question, is to improve things, to improve access to health care, to improve the quality of the care that they are receiving. At the same, you know, often called the working poor, to do so really at equal or hopefully lesser cost to the state of Minnesota. One of the things that threatens the current program right now really is the solvency of the Health Care Access Fund. How does House File 8 do this? Well, using an approach that's really very different than current. Right now, the current program is a capitated model right now that pays the big three carriers, Health Partners, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and Medica, a capitated amount from which they say, the enrollees are put into a managed care system from which they receive their care. They have a scheduled amount of benefits overall, some of which are really not all that adequate. And it puts the provider, our healthcare professionals, really on a specific fee schedule that is very different from the regular private sector. So we're looking at improving access, going to a different model, not necessarily a capitated HMO-style model or managed care model, but for an open access fee-for-service model. State-based high-risk pool is integral to the overall success of the program. The benefits of this approach is that it significantly reduces the cost to cover adults without children or adults with children that are enrolled in Minnesota Care. The most recent fiscal note from last year indicated from DHS indicated $112 million estimated savings just for adults without children alone, roughly a third of the population of Minnesota Care. Our objective also is to bring long-term stability to the Minnesota Healthcare Access Fund. Right now, due to the cost, that program is actually threatened, and by law, disenrollment needs to happen in the event that Healthcare Access Fund is insolvent. And so we're really very much trying to maintain the financial integrity of the Healthcare Access Fund so that Minnesota Care can continue to be offered. The benefits of this approach really are to increase access to private healthcare providers or professionals by paying commercial reimbursement rates as opposed to medical assistance or capitated rates to doctors and other medical professionals. The level of reimbursement needs to be addressed if we're going to be talking about real reform to the healthcare professional community, hospitals, physicians, chiropractors, pharmaceutical companies, because right now the estimated level of payment is substantially lower than the same payment that would be received from the private sector. So our means of solving that is to use the private sector to basically stabilize the amount of reimbursements to our healthcare professional community. Better and broader coverage to adults currently enrolled in Minnesota Care. Adults right now have a $10,000 annual inpatient limit as far as benefits are concerned. And that from a healthcare professional really is, at least in my view, quite scandalous. That is not really a policy that really pays for much significant care, life-saving care, if needed. So, and for many people on Minnesota Care, that's a bankruptcy really waiting to happen in case they have any significant care that's necessary. And nor is it fair to our healthcare professionals either to receive that kind of a limit as far as payments are concerned on this program. The benefits of this approach include reducing current problems of cost shifting from Minnesota Care to the private health care and health insurance market, which is essential to controlling upward spikes in private health care spending trend. Trend is a term for health insurance premium escalations that are largely driven on because of a per unit cost of care delivery. Much of that per unit cost of care delivery basically is the means that what is happening kind of behind the scenes is really the invisible cost of healthcare to our healthcare professional community, because in order to keep the doors open and the lights on, they need to shift costs to the private sector to make up for the inadequate fees that are being paid by the public sector. And if you recall from last time we were presenting, 103 million Americans are on some version of public sector program. So we're talking about roughly a third of the population in this country on public sector plans that are underpaying our healthcare professional community. It's becoming a very serious problem. So when we talk to our individual clients that have health insurance, we talk to our business, our employers, and say, oh, congratulations, you only received a 12% increase in your premiums, all things being equal. That's a very serious problem. Where is that coming from? We're seeking to attack the healthcare premium trend that's going on by finally addressing the cost shifting by putting all the publicly insured on private plans as well. Also, by supporting our healthcare professional community, we're supporting and creating jobs in the private healthcare sector, both in the insurance, quite frankly, and also in the healthcare professional community as well, which is a good thing. By providing our healthcare professionals adequate reimbursement for what they're doing, they're able to hire and provide jobs and benefits and so forth for other healthcare professionals, both at the hospital level and the outpatient professional level as well. So you really can't have, at least in my view, real healthcare reform unless we talk about remedying the inadequate payment schedules that are being received by the healthcare professional community on the publicly insured. benefits on this approach builds on the strengths of community health centers and helps grow, you know, grow their outreach. And they are largely federally funded. There's federal, state, and private sector dollars that are going into community health clinics around the state. We have 96 of them at last count around the state. So for providing really basic health insurance coverage, we also need a mechanism for providing treatment for those that maybe can't afford a copay or whatever. And so by increasing the access of the healthcare the community health clinics as well, that provide a very high level of treatment. They're not hospitals. No, they're kind of little freestanding VA programs that are around the state, whose purpose is to provide health care to low income so that people have universal access to care, at the same time as providing universal access to coverage as well. One of the other things that is important here is enhancing portability of continuation of insurance coverage for those who lose income eligibility from Minnesota Care. So they don't longer have a need to be on Minnesota Care. If they have their own private sector policy, well, great. They just take it with them into the private sector, no longer needing a subsidy. If they're in the middle of treatment, God forbid, you know, we don't want to put them in a position right now if they leave Minnesota Care and they're all of a sudden out of luck, they have no longer have access to the treatment process. So we're looking for portability of coverage from Minnesota Care, back to the private sector when they don't need any further subsidies. So individual policies seem to be the logical approach to this, versus statewide provided health plans, and they're owned and ported by the individual, you know, really wherever they go. John Tyler, Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. So any questions at all about anything that we have that's been included in this presentation?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Tyler. I just wonder if you could give us an idea of what is the cost of underwriting for, you know, if somebody comes in and wants to buy an individual policy, there's got to be some kind of cost associated with doing the analysis that involves figuring out what the risk is for that individual and therefore what their policy will cost. Can you give us an idea of what that process is and what the cost is associated with that? Because if I'm understanding, this bill would require individual underwriting for every person who now doesn't get that underwriting, correct?
Mr. Tyler.
Actually, Madam Chair.
Representative Gottwald.
Representative Liebling, this bill does not require that. This bill offers a subsidy to people so they can go into the private insurance market. Now, the private insurance market, the way it functions, is to do underwriting, but the bill itself does not direct anybody to do underwriting.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gottwald, point taken. It's really a misspeaking, but under this bill, this is what would occur, and presumably that is part of the cost of that would have to be covered by somebody.
Right.
So I'm curious about those costs.
Representative Tyler.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Excuse me, Mr.
Representative
Tyler.
Liebling. If you look at the premium base, you know, that's listed in the bill, those are the premiums that were really actually taken from the private sector individual plan market. And it's part of the function of the roughly 9% of administration costs in total. Health underwriting is part of that overall. That overall expense that is internal to the cost of the premium of the policy. So I would say a portion of that includes marketing, servicing, etc., is going to be health underwriting. I would say probably underwriting is a one-time type of fee. It's not an ongoing process that occurs. So it'll be a very small fraction. I couldn't give you an actual percentage, but it's going to be a very small fraction of that internal 9% administration cost, you know, that it takes to administer plans. And that is part of the overall premium that's charged by the insurance company. There's no additional cost to the state of Minnesota for healthcare underwriting. It's internal to the cost of the health plan itself.
Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, Mr. Tyler, I do understand that it's part of the cost, but I'm just curious about what that cost is. You know, you have a lot of experience in this field and I don't, and I'm just wondering, you know, what does it take to do the underwriting that's associated with selling somebody a policy, and what is the cost range for that?
Actually, I
Mr.
don't know if
Tyler.
That can give you an actual physical cost per policy, because it actually will vary depending upon to the extent to which health screening is required. Sometimes doctor's records are required and requested, and sometimes they're not. So I don't know if that can actually give you a percentage, you know, actually per policy, because it will vary. Most policies, at least in our experience, probably 70% or better, are approved within a couple of days of health screening. So there's a predetermined formula based on health circumstances. So it's very easy to go from an application and the conditions on the application to really the blue book on health underwriting, see if they fit into that mold. So it's not a very big one. I'm sorry I can't give you an actual percentage or an actual cost per policy, because it does vary. Our world record longest term in underwriting took us 4 months to get it, because we couldn't get medical records on a particular individual. So that obviously was a very high cost. Most of them are approved, that quickly, within just a matter of a couple of days. So it's not a very extensive process, fortunately.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just jotted a couple notes down, and I'm not sure you're going to be the most appropriate or whether Representative Gottwald is, but I'll just ask him, and then we'll go from there. It says on one of your first slides, provide better and more comprehensive insurance coverage. And so I guess, does this mean there'll be no deductibles, no co-pays, so that these persons who we already know are quite low income, many of them, the working poor, that they're not going to have the additional costs beyond what we're talking about here? And then I guess I wondered about the bundle or package of coverage that these folks will get to make sure that it is going to have everything they're going to need, that we're not going to be having policies that will, you can get a really cheap policy, but it's not going to cover the things that they're going to need, and then they'll end up having to get coverage elsewhere. I just wondered how that's determined, that we know that it's better and comprehensive.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Norton, this is a different approach, as I pointed out earlier, and this is not a guaranteed benefit set. Although we have looked at the marketplace at what you can purchase for these amounts, and good basic coverage with $1,000 deductible is available. I think what Mr. Tyler was referring to, and I think that's a very important point, is all of these policies that you can purchase on the private market have dollar one coverage for preventive care. Okay, so you get your cancer screenings, you get your checkups, you get all of those preventive care things that we consider very important to basic health care and preventive care. You do not have the $10,000 inpatient cap, which is huge. Talk to hospitals and others about what the cost is when you blow through that and you don't end up qualifying for medical assistance. The cost to both people as well as the health system, because it usually results in uncompensated care, is extraordinary. So the Minnesota Care Benefits Set is not all it's cracked up to be. In fact, I think I recall we had an amendment last year that would have required the Department of Human Services to have some sort of disclosure on Minnesota Care that said right up front that it does not cover you beyond $10,000 inpatient. We now have what is basically an unlimited lifetime maximum under these benefits. So there are some advantages, but what you're not going to get is a defined benefit set. What you are going to be able to do is empower these people to go to the marketplace and choose what they think is best for them.
Representative Gottwald, if I could follow up that.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I did like was that you do deal with that cap, because we've talked about that for years. It is an issue. And yet a $1,000 deductible or $5,000 deductible is going to be equally impossible for low-income people to handle. So I guess I appreciate the $10,000 cap being removed. I think that's a huge benefit. But if what they can afford is going to be something that's a huge deductible, then we've got the same situation where people can't get care and they'll end up in emergency rooms and on and on. So it's kind of a toss-up here.
Thanks.
Well, Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, one thing I would point out is Minnesota Care already has a $1,000 deductible. If you go inpatient, you have $1,000 out of your pocket. So if you think of any circumstance that puts you in the hospital, you're going to have to come up with $1,000 of your own money under Minnesota Care. And when you blow through that first $10,000, which I think a lot of people in the room here could tell you can happen like that, then you're either on MA or you're on your own. And so there are deductibles, and there's cost sharing already involved with Minnesota Care. Now, it is true that if you want to lower the total cost per month, you can increase your deductible. Mm-hmm. But I think the advice that most agents, if you go online, if you're looking at what sort of coverages are available, there are good basic health care packages available with $1,000 deductibles. And again, you don't have that cap on your inpatient stay. And I see some nodding heads from people who are involved in the insurance industry. So is it possible that they might choose something less? Yes. I'm, in a sense, we're kind of relying on people to make good choices, and I think It is wrong to think that people between 133% and 275% of federal poverty guideline are not intelligent or can't make their own decision. And so...
Representative Gottwald, I just want to be
Representative Norton.
I did not say that,
so please
don't put those words in my mouth.
No, and I didn't say you said that, so...
Representative Gottwald. Madam Chair.
So, yes, please, I'm not trying to bait you, but people are going to make their own choices in the marketplace. And what we are trying to do with this subsidy and what we think we've been able to do, when you look at the total amount they can go to the market with, they are able to buy good basic coverage with these amounts of money. And so that, I think, is what we're trying to say by the comprehensive coverage. And I'll let Mr. Taylor perhaps answer it further, if I could, Madam Chair.
Mr. Tyler.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, Representative Norton. The premium base that you see here in the bill was simply copied off of a very basic type of copay type structure that provides 100% on preventive care issues for outpatient services, for physician chiropractic services. Depending upon what they would choose, it would range in copays per office visit between $30 and $50 per visit. Provides a first dollar with copay prescription drug benefit. With actually a fairly high maximum benefit, and gets into the out-of-pocket limits when you get past the copays and so forth, get hospitalized and so forth, and so even if you didn't have any additional employee or individual enrollee expense, you could buy that that structured plan with that premium base. It happens to be Medica's most popular plan, but the Health Partners 3 for Free plan is very comparable. The Blue Cross Blue Shield Simply Blue plan is very comparable. If they wanted something richer than that, they could use what they're already paying for premiums out of pocket right now and buy something more elaborate than that if they so desire. These premiums also include mental health and chemical dependency treatment as well, as far as the policy is concerned. So it happens to be the big three carriers, best-selling plan design that people without a subsidy are actually purchasing in the marketplace for themselves. And you can go up from there as far as someone might choose a high deductible health plan and choose to do an HSA account for example as an alternative to that. So I think we can feel very, very comfortable in a compromise situation. Is we know that we can't provide first dollar benefits across the board for everybody for everything. But that's really where the community health clinics come into play. And so the community having adequate access to the community health clinics that we already have in play, and they're already here, they're already doing outstanding work for our community. If people do have a problem with the copays, they do have a problem with a deductible of some kind, they can integrate that with the community health clinics on a first dollar basis and use the insurance policy kind of as a backup plan for the more catastrophic types of things. Does that answer some of your concerns?
Yeah, Representative Norton.
And I'm sorry, I didn't expect the answers to be that long, and I appreciate the comprehensive answer, but I had just a couple more notes that I wrote down. On that same slide I'd written down, you mentioned fee-for-service, and I kind of thought we, as a state and as a country, were moving away for a fee-for-service model and trying to do some stuff with payment reform and bundles of care, and so I wondered, are you saying that you were preferring to do a fee-for-service so that we're paying for a procedure as opposed to the bundled care, which is what we've been moving toward as a state?
Mr. Tyler.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, yes, absolutely. Okay. And what we're actually looking at here is we have sought out what arguably are the most affordable and premiums and costs that's available in the marketplace. And those plans happen to be individual plans that do use a fee-for-service type of model, as compared to perhaps a more traditional HMO managed care type of model that's currently in play. So when we weigh the two together, that's really where the difference is in the overall costs of the current plan versus a model individually privately owned plan. Is it showing that in this model, the fee-for-service is actually more cost-effective?
Thank you. And I had one last
Representative Norton.
Question. Thank you. On the fiscal notes, you mentioned $112 million savings, and I had written a note. I guess I wondered, does that savings include the cost and price of AMCHA and the use of healthcare access funds as well?
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Norton, well, first of all, this will eventually go to Commerce and then to Finance, assuming it passes this committee. So I don't want to get into the weeds too much about the fiscal note, but The fiscal note had a number of assumptions that we would still like to sit down with the Department of Human Services and talk over. I think we've had some bipartisan concerns about how fiscal notes are arrived at. And I see Representative Hodge smiling and nodding. We still have to get together on a bill to reform that, don't we? We haven't done that yet, but we will. So the fiscal note methodology, I think we mentioned it only to say we believe it does save money. But I want to emphasize this bill is not just about saving money. Obviously, we think it does, but we think this is a more sustainable way, and in a sense, the money piece of it is helping us sustain eligibility and coverage for low-income Minnesotans who need it. The Minnesota Care approach, frankly, has been extremely costly, and we don't know where the dollars are going. $600 per member per month, and we still don't know at a claims level where those dollars are going. So that is a concern to us, and we see that this model actually does work better. There's been talk about doing something similar at the federal level, and it dovetails again nicely. If we do end up doing an insurance exchange, which we have to do probably in the next year, maybe even this session, this is going to allow people to take money and go purchase products in the open market right now, but an insurance exchange eventually. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm just trying to get a grip on some of these questions I had quickly before I forget them, and I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we move forward with Dr. Donnell, and we'll get to the last part of the presentation of the bill and then move on to testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for being able to speak today. My name is Peter Donnell. I'm a pediatrician. I work in a small primary care clinic in Eden Prairie. I'm also medical director for the Children's Physician Network based in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I am coming today as basically a representative of the Minnesota Physician Patient Alliance. And speaking on behalf actually for that relationship between all clinicians, whether they be physicians or chiropractic or mid-level practitioners, but basically the relationship between a clinician and a patient is what we try to preserve and enhance. And so in that regard, any legislation, any statutes which come out to support that enhancement of that relationship from my standpoint, and I believe most of the clinicians, is a good thing, because we think that that's where the important decision-making takes place, that's where the cost savings will happen, that's where the best care will be delivered. And that has been our tradition for those of us that have been in practice for a while, and I believe going forward for Minnesota as a model would be an excellent thing to maintain and preserve. I believe that House File 8, to the best of my understanding, it helps to put a lot of that decision-making back into the hands of the patients in terms of the products that they have. It enhances the relationship between patients and clinicians again, and does a lot in terms of again enhancing the level of care that Minnesotans have come to know to receive and are very happy with that level. There are a number of concerns that those of us who are trying to pay attention to these things have. One certainly is health care costs, and that to the legislature is obviously a very important thing, and especially the health care costs of those who are least able to afford it. They are the ones who will suffer the most if health care costs go out of control. From a clinician standpoint, as a physician standpoint, access to quality health care services is another very important thing, and a concern going forward. Is that going to be maintained within the state of Minnesota? And the action of the legislature in the last couple of years and going forward will have a big impact on that. And then finally, will Minnesota continue to be an attractive place for people to practice in whatever their professional capacity it is? And that is, I think, something that we really need to pay attention to, because not all of my colleagues and the future trainees will want to stay here. They'll go to a state that's more attractive in a lot of other ways. Right now, Minnesota is very attractive, and I would want the legislature to do everything that it can to maintain that. I think that in terms of this particular House file, I think that, the idea here is to enhance the level of health in Minnesota. I believe there are elements here that will lead to that, to enhance the quality of healthcare services, and then finally to make the insurance products as affordable and as obtainable as possible. Those are the kind of things that from a clinician standpoint are really important. And whatever can be done to enhance that, and House File 8 appears to be doing that. I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Donnell. Any questions or comments? Representative Abler.
Thanks, Dr. Donnell, for coming again. You've testified at the legislature before about concerns about access in the clinics being able to maintain seeing Minnesota Care and medical assistance clients over issues of meeting the costs and some clinics that were at risk of maybe not being able to do that. Do you want to offer a thought about that?
Dr. Donnell.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Abler. The concern from, again, from a private practice, this is a private practice independent clinic perspective that I'm bringing, that the rates of reimbursement for an expanded number of children and families on Medicare and Minnesota Care and Medicaid will put us at risk. And there will be more clinics who will not be able to see these patients. There will be more clinics that decide that they will just go with the larger system. They'll close their doors and go to a larger system. The Commonwealth Fund just put out a report in the last couple of months where Minnesota had the ninth lowest Medicaid to Medicare reimbursement ratio in the country. That puts us at risk for those of us who really are committed to seeing patients who are in low income situations. We want to see these patients. Eden Prairie has a large number of immigrants from Somalia. A lot of those patients are covered through Minnesota Care and Medicaid programs, and not being able to see those patients would be a tragedy, both for us as a clinic and also for them as patients. They would have to go to some other clinics. So the rates of reimbursement, frankly, are below the cost of delivering that care. That's truly the cost shifting that has to go to other patients. Unfortunately, with other plans being ratcheted down, it becomes less affordable to see patients under Minnesota Care and Medicaid.
And just one other.
Representative Abler.
One, and I remember you mentioned, this is a year or two ago now, maybe even a little longer, that there were some clinics that were just going to not be able to, they were going to choose not to accept Minnesota Care and medical assistance cases just because they couldn't afford it anymore. Was that right?
Dr. Donnell.
Oh, sorry. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. There are clinics that have decided not to participate in UCARE, for example, which is one of the state public program insurance programs, the companies. There will be an increasing number that will not be able to afford. They'll go to a cash basis or a concierge sort of arrangement.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Donnell, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what your experience has been in terms of uncompensated care and people unable to pay their co-pays, their deductible, because I've been hearing from physicians and clinics and community health clinics that are just overwhelmed, quite honestly, right now with a lot of people with private insurance who, because of their personal budget situations, are not able to pay the co-pays or deductibles. And, you know, and so Minnesota Care and MA may not pay the full cost, but you as a physician and your clinic might be just as at risk if someone's got a private policy with a cost sharing. And in order to qualify for this program, you have to be working poor. So I'm just wondering, can you tell me what your experience has been with collecting those co-pays and deductibles, and if you think that's a continuing concern, particularly given you know, the economy and the ability of working poor people to meet those needs?
Dr. Donnell.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, as an individual clinic, we have a collections process just like most other independent clinics have. Families will make payment arrangements with us. They will not seek care if they lose their insurance plan. So yes, there is risk with any business in terms of seeing patients and working with families. I think that the number of families that are in that category are relatively small at this point, and compared with the and so every clinic that I am aware of will write certain charges off. We will make, like I say, arrangements with the families to pay for bills, and some payment arrangements over several months or a couple years are done. So there are a variety of ways that we try to accommodate the needs of families.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, just a brief follow-up. And do you sense that varies based on whether you work in a lower socioeconomic community versus, you know, if you had a clinic in, I don't know, Minnetonka or someplace where you have a broader mix of incomes within your community? Do you find that in talking to other clinics?
Dr. Donnell.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, there are some clinics. There's one clinic I know, a very small clinic in South Minneapolis that basically sees just Medicaid and Minnesota Care only. It's a much different kind of practice environment. There are other clinics associated with hospital systems that are able to spread that cost over multiple areas. There's federal qualified health centers as well, which also help to support the needs of families in those neighborhoods. Right now, there aren't, with the exception of one or two very small pediatric clinics that I know of, there are no clinics left in Minneapolis, for example. They've all transitioned out to the suburb, whether it be St. Louis Park or... So there are, and one of the few remaining ones that I know of is transitioning to St. Louis Park in the next, I believe, in the next couple months. So the private practices are leaving areas where it's not sustainable to continue to practice in those areas.
Okay, we have one more question from Representative Quam, and then we will try to move on to our testifiers. We have a handful of testifiers as well as amendments to get to. So, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Doctor. And I really appreciate the previous questioning line about the concern for clinics and hospitals, bottom line with this. But is my understanding correct in that you'd be reimbursed at the commercial rate, so you wouldn't have the loss you'd have to cost shift? So I'm seeing this as a net improvement to the bottom line of clinics and hospitals. Am I correctly interpreting this?
Dr. Donnell?
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, the our fee schedule that we accept from various insurance companies varies all over the board. There isn't a, if you will, full cost that any of the insurers will pay us for based on our fee schedule. So depending on what the plan is, what the options are, we would like to have a sustainable level of reimbursement to clinics so that we can offer, for example, medical home and other things that are promoted to be enhancing the care of patients in the long run. Those are the kind of things that are discontinued oftentimes when clinics are kind of trying to manage a very tight bottom line. Does that answer your question?
Representative Quam.
Actually, no, it was more to the point of Minnesota Care's reimbursement rate is less than the reimbursement rate that these plans would have. Therefore, since for the same services provided, the facility would receive greater reimbursement, and therefore the clinic or hospital would be at a better financial footing to be able to handle the write-offs and the other issues. I'm very concerned about rural areas that we are extremely stressed for hospitals and clinics, and so that was my question.
Dr. Donnell?
Madam Chair and Representative Quan, yes, I'm sorry for not being more clear. We would certainly want to obtain a sustainable level of reimbursement to support the operations of the clinic and programs that, frankly, right now we can't afford to do, such as medical home and enhanced patient management and enhanced patient education. So it would allow us to do some of those other things if the level of reimbursement were higher. So, yes, it would be better. It would enhance the health care that Minnesotans receive.
Representative Gottwald, do you have any comments? Okay, thank you, Dr. Donnell. And we will move to our testifiers. We have a handful. If each of you could keep your comments relatively brief to just a couple of minutes. Our first one is Sue Abderholden from NAMI. If you want to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sue Abderholden. I'm Executive Director of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we're a statewide grassroots organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families by providing education, support, and advocacy. And NAMI is concerned about the proposed changes to Minnesota Care in this bill and the impact that it will have on mental health services. In 2007, the legislature passed the Mental Health Initiative in a bipartisan way, which really improved the mental health system. One of the provisions was the adoption of the model mental health benefit set for all public programs. General Assistance Medical Care, Medical Assistance, and Minnesota Care. And these benefits were selected based on research and evidence of effectiveness. And they include things like the assertive community treatment teams, adult rehab mental health services, children's therapeutic services and supports, dialectical behavior therapy, crisis services, and intensive residential treatment services. Our hope was that these benefits over time would actually be adopted by the private sector as well. And while this has begun to happen, the full set has not been fully adopted by the private health plans. If House File 8 were to pass, these benefits would now only be available under medical assistance, and they would not be available under Minnesota Care for both children and adults who live with a serious mental illness. They would actually, essentially, people now would have to prove that they're so disabled that they couldn't work, or their income would be under $8,000 a year for the early opt-in Medicaid in order to benefit from this full benefit set. We're concerned not only that people won't be able to access the model benefit set, but that they won't have coverage for any mental health or substance abuse benefits at all. Now, some of you might be saying to yourself, well, what about mental health parity? Well, mental health parity does not require you to provide mental health care. It just says if you cover mental health, then you have to do it in the same way that you cover other types of health care. But in addition, small employers under 50 and individual policies are exempt from mental health parity. In Minnesota, we do have a strong commitment from our private health plans to cover mental health. And in fact, even though they weren't required to cover mental health treatment for small employers, they did until the legislature passed a law saying that they had to have flexible benefit policies that were free of some mandates, including mental health. So they don't have to cover mental health under individual policies. Many do not cover mental health benefits, or they allow you to opt out in order to lower your premiums. Medica Solo allows people to delete their mental health and substance abuse coverage and thus lower their premiums. Health Partners 3 for Me plan covers mental health office visits, but the rest aren't covered unless you hit a high deductible. Many add extra if you want to cover substance abuse, such as through Blue Cross Blue Shield. People currently pay a premium under Minnesota Care, but they don't pay a deductible for outpatient services. All of these products that I looked at on the internet last night all have high deductibles ranging from $2,000 to $10,000. Most were around $3,000 to $4,000. And for some of the people in Minnesota Care, this would represent a little over 10% of their income. What people currently have under Minnesota Care is the opposite of a catastrophic plan. They have easy access to preventive and basic treatments that really try to prevent chronic illnesses and disability. And NAMI is worried that due to costs, people will no longer access services and treatment that keep them healthy and well. And I want to add that people who are turned away because of a pre-existing condition really won't be able to afford the current premiums under the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. Now, you could say, and we've heard it say, well, this is their choice, but who among us knows what kind of illnesses will develop over time? One in four people will develop a mental illness during the coming year, but few people would say, well, yeah, that's what I'm going to get this next year. I'm going to develop schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or depression. I truly cannot imagine that anyone here would allow or encourage a health plan to exclude coverage for heart disease or cancer or diabetes. Marathon runners have heart attacks, non-smokers develop lung cancer, nothing in life is certain. But again, we as a society would be outraged if there wasn't coverage for heart disease or cancer, for example. But for some reason, it is perfectly okay when it comes to mental illness. Their choice would affect our choices. When private insurance doesn't cover mental health care, then it falls back on our public funding, like state or county grants, to cover the uninsured or the underinsured. Or more likely, it's our criminal justice system that pays. For youth with untreated mental illness, they end up in the juvenile justice system, or adults in the criminal justice system, at significant numbers. 70% of young people in the juvenile justice system have one or more mental health diagnoses, and estimates are that over 25% of our prison population have a mental illness. The other option is for families to simply take on the debt to pay for medications, treatment, hospitalizations, and more. We've all seen, you know, notices for spaghetti dinners to pay for someone's cancer treatment, but I have to tell you, these debts will be faced alone by families. I'm here to tell you there are no bake sales for mental illness. I know and recognize that Representative Gottwell is trying to find new and more cost-effective ways of running the Minnesota Care Program. We've certainly had several discussions about this bill, and I am certainly no expert on insurance and insurance laws. But I truly believe that this change will have a negative impact on the mental health of Minnesotans currently on Minnesota Care, and will increase the demand for other programs that are quite likely to see decreases this session and will be simply unable to meet the needs. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. We have a brief question. Representative Grunhagen.
Madam Chair, Ms. How do you pronounce that?
Abderholden.
Abderholden, okay. My understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, but MCHA, I believe, does cover the model benefits set under mental illness.
Madam Chair, Representative, no.
Ms. Abderholden.
Oh, it doesn't?
No.
It does have some coverage for mental illness.
Madam Chair, Representative, it does have coverage, but it doesn't have coverage of the model benefit set. And the premiums are really very, very high. We have many NAMI members who call trying to afford them, and they're not affordable premiums.
Madam Chair, but just about
Representative Grunhagen.
Ms. Abderholden. The thing, I've sold individual and group insurance for a long time. I've put a lot of people on MCHA, and I've had some who've had mental illness claims. And for the most part, they've been paid in a reasonable way. Mm-hmm. I haven't had any complaints under the MCHA model. So what's the main difference between, do you know, the MCHA model of paying on mental illness versus the model benefit set?
Ms. Abderholden.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. It would not include things like assertive community treatment, which is very effective treatment for someone who has schizophrenia. It would not pay for crisis services, which are a very cost-effective alternative to inpatient hospitalization. It would not pay for intensive residential treatment services. Most likely that one I would have to double-check on, which, again, is a much more cost-effective, cheaper than inpatient hospitalization. And I'm not sure if they pay, again, I don't think they pay for crisis services as well. When we passed the legislation, we included it just on those three programs.
Madam Chair,
Representative Grunhagen.
Ms. Abderholden, I'll have to practice that back at the office. But anyway, but with a $10,000 major medical, even under mental illness treatment, you're going to be without coverage in a short period of time anyway. And, you know, you do have your preventative and your initial treatment under MCHA with a much higher major medical and more benefits than $10,000. So, if a person develops mental illness, even if they choose initially an individual plan without mental illness, they could apply for that benefit. If they're denied, they can go on MCHA and have mental illness coverage in a relatively short period of time. But again, I do believe in personal choice. I've sold the Medica Solo plan. Most people decide not to carry the mental illness benefit, and it hasn't been a problem. I've also sold Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think part of the problem with MCHA is the actual cost of the premium. And if you're low income, that is problematic. And I would, we get over 4,000 calls a year into our office alone with people who actually are struggling getting services in the mental health system that they need. So, it's great that you haven't received those calls, but I have to tell you, I get a lot of them every single day.
Madam Chair, just one follow-up comment.
Representative Grunhagen.
Ms. Abderholden, this bill does structure additional premiums to cover the MCHA benefit. So it does take care of that problem. Okay, with 20% higher overall subsidy besides the subsidy for an individual policy and the premium they're paying themselves for Minnesota Care, you do get additional subsidy. So I don't really see that. I see you're enhancing their ability to cover mental illness coverage in the long run in terms of total claim versus being paid on a Minnesota Care plan, which maybe gives them some initial more benefits, but quickly runs out of benefits and they're on their own and with very little options besides that.
Madam Chair, Representative,
Ms. Abderholden,
$10,000 cap is only for inpatient hospitalization, and so they can have as much outpatient support and services that they need to keep them out of the hospital.
Thank you. Okay, members, we have a... Oh, never mind. We're going to move on to our next testifiers. We have a few more coming. I want to reiterate, if you can keep your comments as brief as possible, we still have amendments and are planning on taking a vote today by the end of committee. Our next testifier is Mary Krinke from the Minnesota Hospital Association. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Bill Author Chairman, my name is Mary Krinke, and for the record, I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I have a couple comments today that are some concerns with the bill that I'd like to share with you. Representative Gottwald has already addressed our first concern with his amendment that I would like to explain just briefly. I'd like to start out with an opening comment, if I can. The Hospital Association recognizes that given our budget situation that we are in, our public programs are going to change, and we are no longer going to be able to pay for things the way we always have in the past. And I would like to recognize that Representative Gottwald's bill is keeping a commitment to cover our low-income citizens. It may not be the coverage that we've had in the past, but it is a partnership with individuals making a contribution and the state making a contribution, as well as our health care access fund, which is a contribution from our providers as well as the health plans. So we are going to be paying for services differently. We all may not like that change, but I think the important thing to recognize is a commitment to continue to cover our low-income individuals. So I think we all have to look at things perhaps differently than we have in the past. So with that as an opening statement, I'd like to comment on three things in the bill. The first one was regarding the targeted or the selected or the population that Representative Gottwald was looking at in this bill. Originally, the bill was slated to cover both single adults without children above 133% and families with children above 133%. It is our understanding that right now the Minnesota Care program has federal matching dollars on families with children. We would be very concerned about losing any of the federal dollars that we have coming into our state right now. We need all of those dollars. So it would be our recommendation that we start this program with single adults without children. That's the population above 133% of poverty, and not to start out with families with children, because that population we get federal money on. If Representative Gottwald's amendment that he did originally to his bill today, it's seeking a waiver. If that waiver request will allow us to continue to get the federal money into Minnesota Care, then that would change the dynamics. But we would be concerned about losing the federal money. Also, I would like to add that the population above 133% is not eligible for the new Medicaid program. I know there are many folks in the room who are not in love with the new federal Medicaid program, but it is the law of the land, and it will be fully implemented in October of 2013. So this population in Minnesota Care above 133% of the federal poverty guidelines is never eligible for the federal match in the Medicaid program. So it is the population to look at in terms of reforming our program. The second point that I wanted to make was exactly what Representative Norton had questioned. And we at the Hospital Association have struggled with the fact that we do have the $10,000 inpatient cap, which then means you're having more uncompensated care above that $10,000 cap versus will you have more uncompensated care when people have a high deductible health plan. And that is what is likely to be purchased when these individuals get a premium subsidy. They are likely to purchase a high deductible health plan. So it would be our suggestion if there was any way to put some parameters. Right now the bill says it's totally free market, it's totally up to the purchaser and the health plan. So if there would be some way to cap
the size of that high deductible plan, I think it would be helpful. I'm not an insurance actuarial person, so I don't know what that cap could be, but we've seen people showing up at the hospitals with a $10,000 deductible, and they simply can't pay it. So it would be helpful to strengthen this bill if we could have a cap on the size of the high deductible. The last point that I just would like to make is the interplay between MSHA and the Health Care Access Fund. The way the bill is worded, it says the Health Care Access Fund shall backfill any of the costs to the MSHA account. That is totally unknown how much that will be, and that is of a concern to the hospital association. There might be a way that we could structure it where it's split, where the healthcare access fund would at least cover the premiums of the subsidy, the amount of the subsidy, and then MSHA would pick up the rest. The bill is structured now where it's the healthcare access fund backfilling all of the MSHA loss, and we would have concerns with that. So, Madam Chair, those are the Hospital Association's three comments on the bill, and thank you.
Thank you. We're going to move right to our next testifier, Matt Schaefer from the American Cancer Society. If you could introduce yourself and give us your brief testimony.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Schaefer at the American Cancer Society. I know you're on a tight timeline, so I'll be brief. House File 8 provides a fascinating approach to providing coverage to those policyholders currently enrolled under MinnesotaCare, and as the discussion on this measure continues, we would encourage the committee to give consideration to how this bill, should it become law, affects access. Primarily, we would recommend the legislature and department take steps to ensure that as policyholders make the transition from MinnesotaCare to a private insurance plan or a high-risk pool, depending on their circumstances, it's a seamless transition where policyholders do not experience a lapse or reduction in coverage. I know currently while applying under MSHA, there is a six-month delay, which oftentimes is waived. It's guaranteed issue if you have continuous coverage. That six-month waiting period, that's obviously a lifetime to a cancer patient. That was one thing that really stuck out to us. We appreciate the bill's effort to limit premiums. We do know that while premiums can be affordable, out-of-pocket costs such as deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance can add up. Looking at House File 8 as a whole, there are a number of opportunities to look at ways to improve access to quality health care coverage, particularly in the private market, and address some of the challenges facing Minnesotans today. We remain very appreciative of Chairman Gottwalt's efforts to make the continued development of this bill an inclusive process and hope there's opportunities to be a part of that dialogue going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. And our last testifier, or testifiers, are Tom Hesse and Lisa Bodine from the Chamber of Commerce. If you could keep it as brief as possible. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber, and my job today is just to introduce you to my colleague, Lisa Bodine, who joined us to lobby health care and transportation issues, and I'll let her take care of the rest. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And as Tom stated, I'm Lisa Bodine with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And this afternoon, I'd just like to offer the Minnesota Chamber's support of exploring new models that restructure the state's health care programs. This will ensure the sustainability of the state's programs into the future. Specifically, the Minnesota Chamber supports models that achieve better outcomes for patients, reduce the cost of health care, and reduce the rate of future cost increases. And with that, we believe that House File 8, the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program, is one to consider for that sustainability. So we urge you as the committee to move House File 8 forward, and to further understand the fiscal implications and the if any impact is to the MNCHA assessments. The Minnesota Chamber appreciates Chair Gottwalt's initiative to explore new approaches to healthcare, and also offer our support in moving this bill forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Bodine. Okay, with that, members, we are going to move to amendments. First, any other public testimony or anyone in the audience who would like to offer testimony? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to actually see if there was anybody here from MCHA, because I think they've been mentioned a lot, and I think it would be very useful if anybody is here in the audience who could give us their assessment of the bill.
Thank you for that. Representative Gottwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Liebling, thank you for the question. We actually did touch base with the MCHIP people. Their director is not available today. I think she would have liked to have been, but their board is aware of what we're doing. We've been in conversation with them over the last 2 years about this. In fact, the section of the bill that refers to keeping MCHA whole is a direct result of our conversations with them. So while I don't think they have anybody here to testify today, we have been working very closely with them on this bill and will continue to do so. I think some of the comments the Minnesota Hospital Association made are valid. In fact, as I mentioned during the presentation of the bill, I think ideally MCHA, the way it functions right now, assesses the cost back to the marketplace so that we're all participating in taking care of the cost of care of the lowest income and the most unhealthy among us. So we'd like to see that mechanism continue, but the way the wording is right now, we're using the Health Care Access Fund to make sure that they understand they're going to be made whole. There are other ways we can do that, and we'll continue working with them, the Hospital Association, and other providers to make sure that that looks the way it should when the bill finally passes.
Okay, with that, we are going to move to amendments. And we are going to try to take a vote, members, here around 410, 415. So we'll get going with these. The first one we have is the A1-1 amendment. Who is authoring that amendment? Is it?
I
okay. Representative Hush moves the A1-1 amendment. You'd like to proceed and explain the amendment, Mr.
Sure, Madam Chair, and also to the author, Representative Gottwalt. First, it's an interesting concept, and I think it's one that I'm glad that we're having a discussion on. However, one of the components and realities of this bill, especially explained in the last fiscal note, was that there was an assumption that at least 20% of people who would normally be covered under Minnesota Care would be dropped off through this plan, and that's mainly due to increased complexities of navigating the system. Just imagine yourself being a young individual having to deal with co-pays and co-insurance, maximum out-of-pocket, and the whole works of purchasing private coverage. This amendment would make sure that we don't have individuals lose coverage who normally would be covered by Minnesota Care, and that there should be a system developed that makes sure that they can navigate the marketplace.
Thank you, Representative Hush. Representative Gottwalt, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hosh. I appreciate the spirit of the amendment. There is a section in this bill that talks about the need for the commissioner to work with the enrollees to coordinate referral to the private marketplace through agents and through other sources. So we envision a means of helping people navigate the system you're talking about. I would also point out that, when we've talked about the uninsured in the state of Minnesota, we've acknowledged that many of the uninsured are already eligible for programs. So we already have a situation where many people who are eligible for Minnesota Care are not choosing Minnesota Care, are not choosing to enroll for it. Is it possible that somebody might choose not to take advantage of a subsidy that the state's offering them? I suppose it is. But I would point out that if somebody needs coverage, these subsidies do get them access to good basic coverage in comparison to Minnesota Care, and it is not necessarily more complicated to get private insurance coverage than it is to sign up for Minnesota Care. So, members, I would urge a no vote on this amendment.
Okay, Representative. Oh, excuse me, Representative Hash.
Madam Chair, just to respond to that, I do think we are adding some complexity because we still have. You still have to go through the eligibility process with the state, get that determination, and then there's the added step to go by the policy on the individual marketplace. And just to be completely honest, part of the savings of this bill, and I think we'll discuss this more in finance, is by 20% of people not being covered that normally would be covered by Minnesota Care.
Representative Gottwalt.
Madam Chair, Representative Voss, just briefly, this is part of the problem that I have with the fiscal note and its methodology. The assumption is that people who are currently on Minnesota Care faced with the option of going without coverage or taking the subsidy and purchasing coverage in the open market would choose not to because somehow it's more complicated. I would disagree with the department on that and have had some conversations with them already. I intend to have further conversations.
But to assume that this bill only saves money by, for one, this bill does not kick anybody off of eligibility. I want to make that very clear. There is no kicking off of coverage in this bill. But I think it's rather interesting to assume that somebody would not, who would go without coverage because they're being offered a subsidy by the state instead of enrollment in Minnesota Care.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gottwald, I appreciate that. And, you know, I mean, I think we all have the same goal here. We all desire for people to be covered and get the care they need. But, you know, if what you say is true, then there wouldn't be any problem putting on this amendment. If people don't become uninsured as a result of this, then it shouldn't matter. And so, you know, I would urge members to support this, and I would ask for a roll call.
Okay, there's been a motion for a roll call. Further discussion on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Gottwald?
No.
Matt?
No.
Abler?
No.
Garrett?
No.
Benson?
No.
Ramson?
No.
Fritz?
Yes.
Dunhagen?
No.
Fosh?
Yes.
Hundley?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Loeffler?
Yes.
Mohmer?
No.
McDonald?
No.
Micklepatrick?
No.
Moran?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Norton?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
No. Okay, there being 9 ayes and 12 nays, the motion is not adopted and the amendment. The amendment is not adopted. Okay, members, the next amendment is the A2 amendment. Who is the author of the A2 amendment? Are we withdrawing the A2 amendment? Okay, it looks like the A2 amendment is withdrawn. Members, with that, we'll move on to the A8 amendment. Who is the author of the A8 amendment? Do we have an author for the A8 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Oh, excuse me, Representative Liebling.
It wasn't mine originally, but I will offer the A8 amendment.
Okay, Representative Liebling moves to amend House File 8 with the A8 amendment. If you'd like to proceed with your testimony or with explaining the amendment, Representative
Liebling. Madam Chair, well, I think it's pretty straightforward. I mean, this kind of goes to the concern that was expressed earlier about having cost-sharing that is just unaffordable. I'm not sure that 10% is the right level, but I think it's good to put something in the bill that limits the out-of-pockets that people might be required to pay. And so I think we should put something like this in. And as I say, it wasn't mine originally, but I think it is a good idea. And obviously, as a bill moves through the process, a lot of tweaking can be done, but I think this should be in the bill.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I would just point out that this is an interesting idea, and as Representative Liebling said, the amount may not be the right amount. I'm more than happy to talk about it, but I would point out that this is a different approach. The state is taking the role of helping people afford what everybody else has access to. The issue here we're trying to overcome is unaffordability for low-income Minnesotans to health care coverage. There are a variety of options available in the individual market with various deductibles and copayments. People's income can fluctuate. Those deductibles and copays can fluctuate. One concern I would have is, how do you track this and how do you administer this? But I would be open to talking with your Representative Liebling if you'd like to. But at this time, I would encourage a no vote on this amendment.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the unaffordability or potential unaffordability is exactly the problem, and that is exactly what this amendment is attempting to get at. And so I would ask for a roll call on the amendment, Madam Chair.
There has been a roll call requested on the amendment. Is there any further discussion? Representative Norton.
Thank you. Just a quick thought as we've been talking about this, and I am supportive. I brought these issues up earlier, and it jumped, you know, straight to my mind as I was listening to the presentation, that we still need to make sure that this is affordable and that people aren't dropping off and unable to afford it. And the other piece that we haven't really talked about is that Minnesota Care had a dental portion and Major Medical does not. So people are already going to be covering dental, I think, on their own now that they haven't before. Is that the case or not? Where does dental fit in this?
Representative Gottwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Norton, thank you for the question. You know, the benefits, the benefit levels available on the individual market, you can purchase dental coverage. The premium subsidy available to people, again, with their own out-of-pocket under Minnesota Care allows you to buy coverage. You can purchase dental coverage. Copays and deductibles, by the way, are things that all of us deal with. And again, I would remind you that if you understand the population between 133 and 250% or 275% of federal poverty, these people are not incapable of handling copays and deductibles. They are low income, but they are not, you know, we're not talking about indigent. And so copays and deductibles are issues for everybody. I deal with them in my family budget. I'm sure most of you do in yours. And I would also add that under Minnesota Care, I don't think we've ever discussed in committee a concern about the affordability for people who have Minnesota Care and end up using up their deductible or their inpatient maximum. So, you know, there's concern all the way around for affordability, but I don't know that this bill necessarily puts people at greater risk in that regard.
Okay, a roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Gottwalt?
No.
Mack?
No.
Abler?
No.
Barrett?
No.
Benson?
No.
Branson?
No.
Fritz?
Yes.
Grunhagen?
No.
Hosh?
Yes.
Huntley?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Loeffler?
Yes.
Lohmer?
No.
McDonald?
No.
Try this again. McGough-Patrick? I'm sorry.
No.
I'm slaying your name. Moran?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yep.
Norton?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
No.
There will be 9 ayes and 12 nays. The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. Mm-hmm. Members will move to the A11 amendment. We have an author moving the A11 amendment.
Madam Chair?
Oh, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A11 amendment. And this addresses some of the questions that we've been wrestling with in terms of making sure that people make wise choices. For many of the people on Minnesota Care, this is the first time they've ever had access to insurance. They are the working poor. They tend to work for companies that don't offer access to health insurance. In fact, that's one of the barriers to getting onto it. They have to not have access to that. And so they have very limited experience in the financial market. And our Commerce Department does establish suitability tests to guide agents and others in as they're working with consumers and understanding what's being available, making sure it fits for that person. And for example, someone who might be dependent on, say, a few hundred dollars a month of inhalers for a child with asthma, it wouldn't be maybe affordable in their budget, even though the monthly premium might be affordable. It may not be affordable in their budget for the out-of-pocket prescription inhalers if that wasn't taken into account in deciding between different products. And so you want to make sure that the people that we're buying health insurance for are actually getting the coverage that their health indicates that they need. And some agents are better than others at translating that. Quite honestly, a lot of people will probably go to the internet and try and purchase things and may not know the fine print. We ran into this with Medicare Part D, where a lot of seniors picked programs that didn't cover the prescriptions they were on. And so this is just to make sure that there's some guidance that helps the insurers in helping our consumers make sure that they get the appropriate coverage for themselves and their kids. And it will also help reduce the uncompensated care, because if it's not covered, we just know it gets absorbed by the provider. And I admire your the effort to try and make sure that our providers are better sustained in this process. So getting people with the right product out of the 1,000 plans that are being offered in the state of Minnesota is, I think, a good thing. And we've done some pretty good quick and easy tests that could solve this. And so I think if we put together both departments working together, they can come up with something that works.
Thank you, Representative Offer. Moves the A11 amendment. Representative Gottwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Representative Loeffler, and members. I appreciate the spirit of this, Representative Loeffler, but you know, suitability is a factor we aren't applying in a lot of other places, and maybe we should or shouldn't, but I would point out that insurance agents, and they're specifically referenced in this amendment, insurance agents shall market to an enrollee only those health plans that are appropriate for the enrollee based upon suitability tests. I would argue that this is a bit naive about what insurance agents are trained and licensed and regulated by the state of Minnesota to do, because they're already required to do this. Their job is to present people with suitable options to meet their needs. We have over 50,000 of these people throughout the state of Minnesota in both rural and metro areas who are perfectly capable of helping people identify what is suitable for them and what isn't. And again, I'm not aware that we do this anywhere else in insurance or coverage law. So this would be rather unprecedented to take this population and suggest that they need this and nobody else does. I would encourage a no vote.
Any further discussion? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Gottwald. We have in other insurance discussions talked about suitability with the Commerce Department, so I don't think it's a foreign concept at all to them. And the concept is, when people apply for these programs, they have to bear every aspect of their financial history and assets. Not everyone wants their insurance agent in a small town to know absolutely everything about every bank account and the value of what they owe. But we've already given that to the state. So the state could create a suitability test that says, we think, even with a reasonable repayment system, this family would never be able to handle more than an annual deductible of $3,000. And so then that would mean that an agent would not be able to offer them a $10,000 deductible policy. And that protects the health provider, that hospital in the small town, the clinic in the small town, because someone isn't sold a $10,000 deductible, they run into health issues, and all of a sudden it's the provider left holding the bag. I think it can be a pretty simple test, but it also, I think, will honor the privacy and respect what we know about the individuals that we enroll in these programs, because they're still going to have to provide all that information at the time of enrollment to prove that they're eligible for the subsidy that your bill creates.
Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the A11 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Members, we're pushing past 4:15, but still intend to take a vote, so we'll get through these last few amendments and then take a vote on the final bill. The next amendment is the A-12 amendment. We have an author for that A-12 amendment, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A-12 amendment. And briefly, what this does is it says when someone is turned down for private insurance, that the agent will assist that person in enrolling with MCHA. And, you know, some will do it voluntarily on their own. This makes it clear that they shall do it, and that we will gather information on kind of the main reasons for people being turned down, whether it's, you know, lack of preventative care because they smoke or whatever. We'll get some insights that we can use in our health promotion activities. And so this will assure that just that people turned down for private coverage get some help applying for MCHA and getting through that process.
Representative Gottwalt, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I appreciate the spirit of this. It's interesting that we're going to this level on a single population, on a single public program for private coverage.
to me, this is a broader thing and maybe something we should discuss further. But at this time, I would prefer not to add this as an amendment on this bill.
Any further discussion to the A-12 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
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 The motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. The next amendment is the A-15 amendment. We have an author for that, Representative Loeffler, to the A-15 amendment.
Madam Chair and members, this is my last amendment, and I think it's one of the most important, in that Minnesota's been recognized nationally, and we, on a bipartisan basis, have supported gathering information on quality and outcomes on the on the coverage that we provide. That's part of why we have some of the lowest cost insurance and highest quality outcomes in the nation. And we also are at risk of federal sanctions, which in a tough budget, you don't really want to encourage that. There's federal sanctions if we don't get enough kids through the child and teen checkup program, those sorts of things. And so this would just say that the Commissioner of Human Services and in cooperation with the Commissioner of Health should develop an appropriate outcome thing. And I think this will be key to getting the federal government to approve any kind of waiver from the existing system. And so I would encourage a yes vote, and I would ask for a roll call on this.
There has been a roll call requested by Representative Loeffler. Representative Gottwalt, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I guess I'm a little puzzled, and it may well be a requirement of waivers, Representative Loeffler, but we've talked many times in this committee about the concern for this under other public programs, including Minnesota Care, where we cannot even determine where the dollars are going. And now we're directing the Commissioners of Health and Human Services to put this program under a microscope because we're spending some public dollars to help people afford private health care coverage. I don't object at all to the idea of trying to make sure of where the state's dollars are going and what ROI, although return on investment is a pretty broad term, and I think it needs to be detailed more. And again, I'd be glad to work with people on this, but I'd like to see us apply this to everywhere where we're spending money in public programs. Why this comes only on at this point, I don't know, but wherever there are state dollars invested, we ought to be identifying whether or not they're accomplishing what we intend them to. And under current traditional Minnesota care, we simply don't.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, I respectfully say I would not say that that's true. We actually do have performance withholds. We have a quality assurance department within the Department of Human Services that keeps track of diabetes care, about whether or not we're meeting the federal child teen checkup preventative care requirements under medical assistance. There's a whole variety of measures that providers have to provide. The encounter data to the health plans, and then the Department of Human Services analyzes it. So it just would say that this is actually treated like all of our other programs, and we continue to make sure that we are getting care for the people that we're investing in these premium subsidies. So I would say that it would just be continuing our tradition of that we have in the other programs that are under our public health care programs.
Representative Gottwalt.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I would just point out that return on investment implies that we know what we're getting for the dollars we're spending, and I would argue that we do not know that with Minnesota Care right now, with all due respect to quality measures and so forth. I would renew my offer to work with the author of the amendment to develop something more comprehensive in this regard, but at this time I'd encourage no vote.
Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just a little perplexed because we should be doing this everywhere. We can't be doing it here. I mean, one of the very interesting things about this bill is the question, where is our money going? Are we overpaying for our current public programs? And we need to get an understanding. But shouldn't we start somewhere? And I think this is a reasonable place to start. If it's good for everything, it should be good for this.
Representative Gottwalt.
Madam Chair, I would agree, and frankly, if we would work on this and get the language a little clearer, I would be more than happy to accept this amendment. There are two other committees this needs to go to. If the author of the amendment is sincere about wanting to apply this, there are going to be opportunities to. But I don't agree that the language is sufficiently clear right now. Return on investment is a broad term. I think you need to put some detail to what you mean by return on investment, and we also need to get at where the dollars are being spent. And so I think this could actually be expanded a bit and more detail added to it, because I agree it ought to be applied in more places, but I'd like to see some more stuff done with this before it gets added to the bill. That's my only point.
Madam Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
I don't have the pleasure, because we're now only on three committees, of serving on those other committees, and I would ask the committee to put it in as a placeholder, and I will continue to, outside of the committee process, work with Representative Gottwald and others on trying to how to reform this. But I think putting it in is a statement of health care policy, and that's what this committee is. And I think it's part of the reform of our responsibility. So I would hope that we could put it in the policy committee as a statement of health policy and then work on refining it. We know most bills have to have a little bit of refinement before they're ready for the floor, and I would be glad to be part of that and work with anyone on the committee and Representative Gottwald who'd like to refine that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having worked with quality systems and approaches, you want to have a universal approach when you try to have bit-wise to different programs. You end up not having a consistent and a efficient way of doing quality. So I would agree that what we need to do, instead of introducing a placeholder, that we need to seriously consider a comprehensive quality approach for HHS. And so I agree with Representative Gottwald in that this is not the appropriate vehicle to promote quality.
Okay, Representative Loeffler has moved the A15 amendment. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Gottwald?
No.
Mack?
No.
Abler?
No.
Barrett?
No.
Jensen?
No.
Franson?
No.
Ritz?
Yes.
Grunhagen?
No.
Hosh?
Yes.
Huntley?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Loeffler?
Yes.
Lohmer?
No.
McDonald?
No.
McElpatrick?
No.
Moran?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yeah.
Norton?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
No.
There being 9 ayes and 12 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, I'll renew my motion that House File 8 be recommended to pass as amended.
There is one more amendment. Our last and final amendment, so we'll cruise. Representative Murphy moves the A18 amendment. Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Representative Gottwald, in his introductory remarks, made reference to a health insurance exchange and this being a fundamental piece of a health insurance exchange. And when an exchange is in place in Minnesota, it will come with a benefit set that's standard. So people that purchase through the exchange will understand the benefit set. I think that we've had testimony today from Ms. Aberholden and others that the benefits available to those with mental illness and chemical dependency are in doubt in the private market at this time. And we know that both the chronically mentally ill and the chemically dependent those are diseases that are difficult for people. And I think that they would be better served at this point in Minnesota care with the benefit set that's known, with the model mental health benefit set that is known. And so I'd ask that we exclude those two conditions from Representative Gottwald's proposal and leave them in Minnesota care with the benefit set that is known. I'd appreciate your support and I'd ask for a roll call. Thank you.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Discussion to the A18 amendment. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I have talked with Ms. Afterhoven and the NAMI people. I'm willing to work with them on those issues, as I think we need to on a number of public programs, but to carve this out, if you will, kind of goes against what this is about. This is about the state's role being to help people who cannot afford private health insurance coverage to help them afford that. I understand the concerns about mental health and chemical dependency coverage, but I think even Ms. Abderhoven in her testimony indicated this is a much broader issue. And if we want to deal with it across the private market, there is a much different approach we would want to take to that. I think carving it out of this particular program would actually be, against what we're trying to do with it, and that is simply extend people the affordability of private insurance coverage. If we want to mandate mental health and chemical dependency coverage in private insurance marketplace, maybe that's what you'd like to pursue, Representative Murphy, but I don't think this is the place to do that. So I would encourage a no vote.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Representative Mack. I don't have a preference over the private market and public coverage, but I do have a preference for sick people getting the care and treatment that they need. When we had testimony the other day from the gentleman talking about private insurance, one of the things that they told us is that one of their primary goals is to make sure the people that already have coverage are protected from risk. And we know that both chemical dependency and mental health are chronic conditions that cost a lot of money. And I think that they would be bounced out of the private market, as we've seen, countless times. We already know that that exists. So I think, while I understand Representative Gottwalt is making a case for the ability for people to buy in the private marketplace, this population, I think, will not be successful there, and their treatment will be interrupted as a result. And so I think it would be important to carve them out. Minnesota Care remains intact in Representative Gottwalt's legislation. There isn't a reason why the commissioner couldn't pay fee-for-service payment for the treatment for those people to make sure they're getting the care that they need and they're staying healthy and well. And so I would ask for your support. Thank you.
Okay, roll call has been requested. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll on the A18 amendment.
Gottwalt.
No.
Mack.
No.
Abler.
No.
Garrett.
No.
Benson.
No.
Franson.
No.
Fritz.
Yes.
Grunhagen.
No.
Osh.
Yes.
Huntley.
Yes.
Giffmeyer.
No.
No.
Liebling.
Yes.
Loeffler.
Yes.
Lohmer.
No.
McDonald.
No.
Kirkpatrick?
No.
Moran?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Norton?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
No.
There being 9 ayes and 12 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Representative Gottwalt, to the bill.
Madam Chair, if there are no further amendments, I will renew my motion that House File 8 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform.
Okay. Representative Liebling, to the bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to make a brief statement. I'm sorry, Representative Gottwald, I tried to get in there before you made your conclusory statement, but I just wanted to say that, I do appreciate the effort that you're trying to make here, and you've said you really want in this bill to help people buy private coverage. But my interest is less in having them buy private coverage than in having them have care when they need it. And I think that this is all something that we share, and I'm going to vote no on your bill, but because I think it does a couple of things that I'm really concerned about. I think that what it would do is really cherry-pick healthier individuals into the private market and then ultimately leave the people who have pre-existing conditions and other challenges again back on the public rolls. And we've talked about MCHA, and right now as the bill has the backfilling from MinnesotaCare, and you've said that you would be adjusting that, looking for other ways, but the bottom line is that it has to be backfilled from somewhere. So I'm just concerned, and I hope I would be wrong, I'm concerned that this bill not only costs less, but it does less for people, and that ultimately what's not covered under this bill would go back onto taxpayers and be more expensive in that way. And so I hope that perhaps at some point this bill might be in a form that I could support. I'm not saying that I never would or that I wouldn't ultimately support some kind of a trial run for it, but right now I'm going to vote no on it. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gottwalt.
Madam Chair and members, just briefly, I think all of us need to understand a little bit better how the private marketplace does and doesn't cover people for care. I will remind you again that we are headed towards bankruptcy in state public programs. If we do not start doing these kinds of things, you're very concerned about whether or not people get the care they need is going to become a huge issue, a much bigger issue when they lose coverage altogether. This is an opportunity to get people coverage they need, good basic coverage, that many others of us enjoy in the marketplace. People will not be thrown off of coverage if The term cherry picking, I think, underscores the fact that some people don't understand insurance as well as others. MCHA is meant to reassess back to the entire marketplace the cost of those who are considered fairly seriously ill or of higher risk. So we are all helping pay for those people one way or the other. And if they continue Minnesota Care coverage uninterrupted, they have guaranteed issuance. They will get coverage in MCHA.
Individual.
So we need to think about what works and what doesn't work in the existing marketplace and how we can help people access that. And in that way, maintain eligibility and access to care. That's exactly what this is about.
Okay, members, Representative Gottwalt renews his motion that House File 8 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
No.
The bill passes and is re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. Thank you, members. This committee is adjourned. As amended. Oh, you've